Money FM 89.3, the best of Saturday mornings. International News Review.
Time to bring on Steve Okun on International News Review. Steve, welcome back. Great to see you.
Great to have the three amigos reunited.
There we go.
There we go.
First story up, the first ever trilateral summit between the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines. Talking about this Indo-Pacific relationship, stability, et cetera, countering any Chinese provocations in the South China Sea. How did this summit go? Did it really accomplish anything?
I think it really did, and it's part of what the U.S. is now referring to as its lattice work towards foreign policy.
Oh, we have a lattice work.
We nice. Now have a lattice work.
We've gone from a framework to a lattice work.
Well, a lattice work is made up of multiple frameworks.
Oh.
And so you're not going to have a European-style alliance system like NATO. That is not going to work in Asia. And it doesn't work if you just have, you know, bilateral alliances between the U.S. and Japan and the U.S. and the Philippines and the U.S. and Korea. But you want to create this lattice work of mini laterals and groupings that can come together that, frankly, is to resist China in this part of the world.
And coffee clatches and a cornucopia of good-feeling meetings.
Exactly.
Well,
yes.
I wouldn't call these good-feeling. I mean, they were real. I mean, there's not only these meetings, there's military exercises happening. And while I think you would see it as a success from a U.S.-Japan-Filipino perspective, the Chinese were not happy. And you know, China, after this, summoned the Japanese and Philippine diplomats into Beijing to express their dissatisfaction over the negative comments that were made. They made solemn representations to the Philippine ambassador of the negative words and deeds the Philippines were using against China. So, I mean, this is taken as a serious threat from the Chinese and hopefully seems to be working from the other countries' perspectives.
Well, it was ironclad. I noticed Biden likes the word ironclad a lot lately. So this is the latest ironclad commitment, defense commitment between the US, Japan, and the Philippines. Look, there's a lot of geopolitical posturing. You would expect that. A lot of saber rattling from both sides. But what does it actually achieve? Does it not exaggerate tensions rather than soothe tensions?
Well, I mean, you say saber rattling, but there's a lot more than saber rattling than what's going on in the South China Sea. You have China has repeatedly obstructed Philippine vessels exercising their rights to navigation. They've disrupted supply lines to the Second Thomas Shoal, which is part of Philippine territory, which the Chinese contest, and they've lost that before the UN. You've had, you know, water cannons, and you know, you say, oh, it's just water. I mean, but these are causing injuries to Philippine sailors. So it's not saber rattling what's happening in the South China Sea. And that is why you are getting this reaction and you're getting a military exercise that took place between the U.S., Australia, Japan, and the Philippines. You then have this trilateral that occurred. You're having more military exercises taking place with the U.S. and Korea about what's happening in North Korea. So it's in an effort to try and keep stability in the South China Sea, in the Western Pacific. And it goes well beyond saber rattling. We're past that right now.
But just to add to that, does it have an impact? As you said quite rightly, China's already responded, claiming their reputation has been smeared again. They're being attacked again. They're not going to stop, are they? They claim almost the entirety of the South China Sea. My point is, what happens next? Is China going to back down? Unlikely.
Well, again, is China going to back down, or is China going to get more aggressive? And what this latticework policy is to try and prevent that from happening, to show to China that if you don't respect international law, if you don't respect the right to navigation, if you don't respect countries' territorial integrity when it comes to the South China Sea, and if you do take military action, you are going to be met with military action. And so there's real geopolitical risk right now in our part of the world, in the South China Sea. And this is what is aimed to prevent that from happening. And it's why the U.S. is now looking, or I should say the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. are exploring bringing Japan into AUKUS, which I guess we're going to have to rename into JAUKUS.
It's a better name. It's a better name.
And so if you have JAUKUS, then Beijing really said we are going to take this as a
prince of provocation, right?
Yeah.
And look, see, I'm not expecting you to reply for the U.S. military industrial complex, but let's face it, you know, we've had these alliances, Korea, Vietnam, Japan, Philippines, all throughout the South China Sea for decades. The U.S. has conducted freedom of navigation exercises for decades. And the bottom line is China believes it is their territory based on historic records and maps and things. You know, international bodies have all said no. And so, you know, this wash, rinse, repeat cycle is not going to change unless somebody literally blows somebody out of the water, which nobody wants to do and have happen. So, you know, like, what are we actually talking about here? I mean, we can have all the trilaterals or quadrilaterals or whatever laterals we want.
Ironclad.
But and ironclad relationships. But where does it actually go? Because one of the main protagonists believes this is their right. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, and that's the question is, what do you do? Are you going to just sit back and do nothing as you and this is something that China has become much more aggressive in laying out what its claims are. It has become much more aggressive in enforcing what it believes to be its territorial rights, which, frankly, no one else agrees with. And so do you just sit back and not do anything, or do you take action, which is to show that international law needs to be respected? And that is what the U.S. and Japan and the Philippines and Korea and Australia and Vietnam are all doing.
And Taiwan. Sorry, I forgot to mention them earlier. But yeah.
Yeah. And Taiwan's kind of into its own case in
a
way.
It's got its own issues.
It's a different issue. Yeah. But that's the question is, how serious is this going to go? Because the flashpoint right now that, you know, we always focus on Taiwan is the flashpoint if there's going to be military action in the Pacific. But it could really be the Philippines. And this is a way to stop that.
And of course, you know, the parting comment on that, business around the region doesn't like this uncertainty. They want to have a more clear picture that there is going to be peace and stability for people and for business and for trade and everything else. All right, let's move on to our second story. TSMC, the huge chip maker out of Taiwan, announcing with the Department of Commerce up to $6.6 billion in a third leading edge fab production facility in Phoenix, Arizona. Good news for the local economy there. Is this part of the strategy to sort of spread out the chip making?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, this is the U.S. and other countries as well seeing that they are at serious supply chain risk if they aren't making leading edge, you know, semiconductor chips in the U.S. And right now, you have those leading edge chips that the U.S. uses for its national security are coming from one company, typically in one location, and that is Taiwan. And so if you're the U.S., you don't want to put all your national security eggs in one basket. And so how do you get chips to be made in the U.S.? Well, the U.S. government says we have to subsidize that. We have to incentivize TSMC in particular. Other companies as well are doing it, but TSMC in particular, to take that manufacturing into the U.S. so that we can make our supply chains and our national security much more resilient. So this is part of one of the signature laws that was passed in the Biden administration, the CHIPS Act. So this time you have $6.6 billion coming in.
It sounds like a very good Trumpian policy. He wanted to produce homegrown stuff. Is this something that Republicans will get on board with?
Well, yeah, no.
It's a very Republican mindset. I know why, from a geopolitical standpoint. You don't want all your eggs in one basket geopolitically. But it's a sort of policy that would play on both sides.
You would think so, except it was Donald Trump. You know, what did they do when they had Congress? They did the tax cuts. What did President Biden do when he has the Congress in bipartisan? We have to focus on infrastructure. And so this is one of the things, and where you have an example of good policy and good politics intersecting. Arizona is arguably the single most important state in the 2024 election. It is a swing state when it comes to Biden and Trump. You have a Senate race that is up for grabs. You have two House seats that are up for grabs. You have a state house that can go from the Republicans to the Democrats. And now you have an abortion law from the Civil War in effect that can get overturned through a referendum. So having a $6.6 billion, the dollar investment that President Biden announces with his, you know, Commerce Secretary is great politics, great policy.
If that doesn't buy enough votes to win the election, I don't know what does.
I don't know, especially when Trump has had a shocking week anyway. He's had one of his worst weeks in recent memory with the cases, and the abortion issue is really starting to bite.
All in Arizona. And so this is something. Now, what's interesting, though, is as the U.S., of course, is, you know, this is industrial policy from the U.S. Of course, it is complaining about China's industrial policy when it comes to electric vehicles. So you have the Secretary of the Treasury in Beijing saying to China, you are subsidizing unfairly your electric vehicles, and we're not going to allow you to export that to the United States. And at the same time, of course, you have the United States subsidizing in you know, to build these semiconductor plants. So it's a little bit of an interesting dichotomy. The U.S. will say semiconductor is national security. That is very different than EVs and batteries. But this is where the world is heading. And as Neil, you pointed out, you know, having an industrial policy, having a nationalism is something that countries are really heading to.
Yeah.
Part of it's the lesson from COVID. Part of it is the what's happening with semiconductors and what you saw happen when you have a disruption with those. It can really hurt your entire economy.
Just to add to that, I was genuinely shocked reading this story that Apple and others rely almost exclusively on chips from this one company manufactured in Taiwan, which just doesn't seem like good business in the age of the polycrisis.
There's very few alternatives. That's the challenge, right?
True.
Because it's such a precise, such a precision product, right? Mm. And TSMC has mastered it decades ago. Right?
And that's why the U.S. in the CHIPS Act, you know, that was signed by President Biden, put $50 billion earmarked into manufacturing of chips because the U.S. is that far behind. Yeah, I mean, Japan's trying to do so now. Korea's trying to do so now. The Netherlands is there. And China is very worried about getting cut off. And so they're subsidizing this as well. But yeah, it is – you have – one of the most geopolitical hotspots is where almost all of the world's chips are being made. And it's a real concern, not just for the U.S., but for everybody.
All right. That is a great topic, by the way. And we saw that author months ago at 1880 talk about – I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name in his book. But very, very important book about the chip wars. I think that was the name
of
the book.
But it is becoming the oil of the earlier part of the 21st century, whatever you want to – whichever.
Yeah. It's important stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Chris Miller who wrote Chip Wars, which is called The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. And I'm actually reading it now. I finally got it after seeing him. So I do recommend that book. It really is enlightening as to how we got to where we are and what this means going forward.
All right. Singapore. Is Singapore losing its shine, Steve? We've got a number of companies that have announced that they are moving at least some of their functions out of Singapore due to cost pressures, some going to Malaysia, some going elsewhere. Give us some perspective on this, because not everyone's leaving en masse, but some are.
I saw this headline, and the headline in a Nikkei article was, Singapore loses shine as Southeast Asia base for MNCs. I'm like, oh my God, I got to read this. That is one of the most ridiculous headlines.
Go on, Steve.
Misleading headlines.
What were they thinking? I mean, this is, it's just, it's not true. And the article closes by saying, Singapore still has the advantage in location, language proficiency, and financial services. It does not appear that the city-state will be dethroned as the prime spot for regional headquarters.
What? Steve.
Why are you putting this in the
headline? Can you ever imagine somebody posting something on social media with a clickbaity title?
Never.
That would never happen.
No, I mean, somebody who could work into an article, Chris Martin and Coldplay and Taylor Swift.
I was talking about your post.
I thought you were talking about Neil's latest article.
I only write things that go viral. You two fight amongst yourselves. There you go.
Well, my post here did go viral, Mr.
Okay, so, so what's
so,
actually
28 books.
What's actually happening? Because some companies. Companies are leaving, as they always have. They've left for a variety of reasons. But what was the point in the Nikkei article?
The goal of Singapore has been, like, let's have the regional headquarters here. Let's have the decision makers here. Mm. Now, if you want to then, I think, take, you know, the functions one step down from your regional leadership. Do you want to have your, you know, your finance and accounting or your
the
HR?
Back office
your,
stuff.
It could be back office or it could be managers. I mean, and you know, serious business, but not at the top lines. Go somewhere that is more affordable. Go to Malaysia. Go to Thailand. And this will actually help Singapore because it will, you know, because people here, of course, are always complaining. There's too many people here. I can't get, you know, the metro's crowded. The hawker centers are crowded. The schools are full, et cetera, et cetera. So you have the best of both worlds if you have the regional headquarters here and you have the sub-regional team throughout ASEAN. And that's exactly what is happening. And you see the article talking about, you know, where multinationals are shifting some of their Southeast Asian regional headquarters functions outside Singapore to leverage cost savings and growth opportunities. And you see Malaysia taking advantage of this with changes in their laws. Mm. You see Thailand taking advantage of this. So, you know, Malaysia having tax incentives, preferential income tax rates to attract people. And so the article talks about how certain Japanese companies are taking advantage of this. This is it is good for the region. So I think you could, you know, if the headline had said multinationals, you know, having a regional strategy with Singapore at the core, that would have been the accurate headline.
From an economic standpoint, of course, no question. But as always, from a sociological standpoint, could you make a case that if we're just focusing on regional heads and sub-regional teams go elsewhere, it could tap into that elitist viewpoint that we're becoming more elitist, more detached, more wealthy, and the middle tier, lower middle class, whatever you want to call them, are going elsewhere? So could you not make a case that it makes Singapore look even more elitist, more expensive? I'm sure the five-star hotels will do well from this. What about the middle guys, the hawker centers, the day-to-day guys who make money from those regional teams?
Well, I mean, you
HDB flat rental, for example.
Well, the question is, are you going to have is there a limit on how many people can be in Singapore? And I think the answer to that question is yes. I mean, there's only so much space and there's only so much infrastructure. And so when you have those people, what do you want to do in terms of, you know, maximizing your tax revenue, maximizing the amount of money you can have as a government to then have more services and better services? So I would think, like, it's you're not going to have only the highest of the income workers here, but it would certainly make sense. You want to have more companies here, more decisions to be made here, more revenue generated here for Singapore, and then have, you know, a shifting of some of those functions elsewhere. I think the Singapore government would make perfect sense. Yes, it does. I'm not saying it doesn't come without challenges, but you want to have the same number of people here. You'd want the people at the top to make more than otherwise, because then it helps with all of the infrastructure you want to build.
All right, last topic of today, the heat in Southeast Asia. Vietnam declared a state of emergency recently after abnormally high temperatures in the south dried up rice fields. In the Philippines, hundreds of schools suspended classes. Sweltering heat is back in Southeast Asia. 675 million people, 11 countries. This is not a good sign after just having come off the hottest year in record, 2023.
Yeah.
And it's only getting worse. And this is something that now everybody has to take into consideration. Governments have to take it into consideration. They have to take it in consideration on how they're going to provide education.
Yeah.
Are they going to keep schools open? Are they going to have to shut down schools? And then obviously that is going to have huge knock-on effects. What are the businesses going to do? How are they going to protect their workers? And now you see this
and,
cycle.
And food security.
Well, food security and everything that goes with this. And what you're seeing, you know, I'm having people tell me, you know, it is getting so hot here now, I'm using the air con more than I've ever used it before.
Mm.
Now you're only adding to global warming, right? So the hotter it gets, the more air con you use, the more, you know, the more emissions you have, and now you're only going to make it worse. So how are we going to address all of this? And so it is a whole of society problem, and there don't really seem to be a lot of solutions coming.
Well, one obvious one from your neck of the woods, ESG regulations, thinking aloud. Is this something now, it's gone past a woke initiative, companies trying to look good and tick boxes. Is this some point going to have to be mandated, state legislated, whatever you want to call it? All companies must reach and abide by certain ESG regulations as standard.
They are. ESG is so broad, but let's say so. Certainly, when it comes to worker health and safety, you are seeing laws like Singapore has right now that are going to mandate if the temperature is at a certain range, you have to have so many water breaks. You can only work for so many hours. So you're starting to see that come in. But the question is, what are you going to do to reduce energy usage? Mm-hmm. Are you going, you know, so Singapore is starting very slowly with a carbon tax. At least it has one. But if you're not going to put a price on carbon, are you going to be able to really address the issue? And when you see parents not being able to send their kids to school, then maybe this will be more of a wake-up call that governments have to do the hard thing, which is forcing people to ration. I mean, when you put a carbon tax on, you're going to have to ration. You're going to tell people, no, you can't use your aircon in Singapore during certain hours. That's going to be where you're going to see the real crisis coming, and we're not there yet.
Yep. Steve, thanks so much for that. We have got to leave it there. All good stuff. We may talk to you next week. You'll be in Thailand.
I will be in Bangkok next week since Mr. Humphreys refuses to go. I never said that.
He's the ultimate headline spinner, isn't he? He moans about headlines.
I'm shocked at both of you.
Glenn loves Bangkok.
I'm appalled.
We love Thailand. Neil goes to London. He goes to Margaret River. Mr. Posh over there.
The day that Steve Aoki plays the man of the people over me is the day it's all over.
This is so much fun. Excellent. Thanks, Steve. We'll talk to you soon.
See you soon.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO. Audio at the App Store and Google Play.